KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Officials in Manitoba have identified one of two sets of remains found last month at a Winnipeg landfill site. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, police have confirmed those remains belong to one of four Indigenous women murdered by a convicted serial killer.
The remains of Morgan Harris were positively identified by forensic officials. They were found 2 weeks ago at a landfill north of Winnipeg. A second set of remains have not yet been identified, but are likely those of another victim of serial killer Jeremy Skibitzky, an Indigenous woman known only as Buffalo Woman. Advocates for missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and gender-diverse people are praising the Harris family for their strength and determination after they fought for the search of the landfill site. Praise also came from Manitoba Premier Wab Kanu.
So I don't think any of us would ever want our loved ones to go through what Morgan Harris went through. However, through this journey, we have seen some remarkable strength and resilience and power from the family of Morgan.
A former Grand Chief of a group of Northern Manitoba First Nations, Sheila North, also acknowledged the strength and love of the families for their efforts. And Wab Kanu says he hopes the family will have some sense of closure and healing now that they will be able to hold a sacred ceremony to memorialize her. The families of missing and murdered Indigenous women and children worked alongside forensic anthropology students to search the landfill. Some Indigenous leaders and advocates who pushed for the search said the remains wouldn't have been found without the efforts of the Canadian government and the current provincial government. Winnipeg police and the former Conservative government of Manitoba argued against searching the landfill because of safety concerns. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Joe, do you copy? Joe, it's Shane.
The hit thriller mystery show Dark Winds kicked off its third season over the weekend. The new episodes have Navajo police officers Joe Leaphorn and Jim Chi investigating the disappearance of two boys and an FBI agent probing the death of the wealthy and powerful B.J. Vines from last season. Zahn McLarnon plays Leaphorn.
Season 3 is basically a continuation, exploration of the tragedy that befell the Leaphorn family from the previous seasons with their son, the ramification of their son's death, and what consequences come to Joe Leaphorn for his actions he did last season, how it affects his mental state, and how it affects his marriage with his wife, Emma.
The third lead in Dark Winds is Jessica Matson, who plays Bernadette Manulito. Season 3 finds her hundreds of miles away working with the U.S. Border Patrol. Matson wasn't available for an interview with National Native News, but co-star Kiowa Gordon says her character and Jim Chi still connect.
Jim's not one to give up on something that he wants in his life, so I don't think we've seen the last of that pairing between Bernadette and Jim Chi, because even though there may be some love triangle forming through this Ivan character, you know, I think we can't ever count out Chi and Bernadette having a reunion, and I'd hold on to that hope.
Meanwhile, showrunner John Wirth says the series' success comes from revisiting Tony Hillerman's novels through the lens of Navajo and other Native American cast and crew members, including consultants.
It's a wonderfully functional, dysfunctional group of people. All of us have the same desire to tell a really gripping story and to honor the traditions out of which these characters come, both the fictional world of Hillerman and also the historical world and the real world of the Navajo Nation.
Dark Winds airs Sunday on AMC. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios in Eugene, Oregon.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by DT Track, your healthcare partner, providing access to a nationwide network of qualified healthcare temporary staff, including medical billing professionals that optimize your revenue cycles. DT Track will be at the Reservation Economic Summit, Booth 214.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
It would be catastrophic, not only for the healthcare system, for Alaskans across our entire state.
Experts say Medicaid cuts would have an outsized impact in Alaska. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 10th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a California company says it can provide some of the data lost from National Weather Service cuts.
In some sense, the more remote that an area is, often the more valuable the data is because you have no other data nearby.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Congress is considering huge cuts to Medicaid, the government-funded health insurance program that covers nearly 40% of Alaskans. If federal funding is substantially reduced, many Alaskans could lose their insurance, and the strain would be felt throughout the healthcare system. Alaska Public Media's health reporter Rachel Cassandra has spent the last week or so diving deep into the complicated world of Medicaid and why cuts may have an outsized impact in the state. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Casey.
Okay, remind us, what is Medicaid?
So Medicaid is a public insurance program. It's mostly for low-income Americans and some people with disabilities. The state splits those costs with the federal government. So for regular Medicaid, it's split 50-50. And for a few programs like those that cover pregnant women, we have a higher federal match. And then as part of the Affordable Care Act, Congress expanded Medicaid to serve people whose income is slightly higher and also single people. Medicaid expansion now covers 76,000 Alaskans by last count. It has the highest federal match of all Medicaid programs in the state at 90%. And then in Alaska, we also have Denali Kid Care. That's Alaska's name for the Medicaid program for kids. In other places, it's called CHIP.
Gotcha. So how many Alaskans, and talking about all of Medicaid, how many Alaskans have health insurance through Medicaid?
About 38% of Alaskans, 279,000 people were on Medicaid in 2024. According to the State Department of Health, that includes 60% of Alaska children, more than a third of Alaska adults, and 15% of seniors over 65. Alaska's heavily dependent on the program. Last year, only New Mexico had a slightly higher percentage of its population on Medicaid. And more than one in three births in Alaska were covered by Medicaid last year, according to the state's vital statistics report. That's partly because of increased eligibility for pregnant and postpartum women.
Okay, so, I mean, the idea of cutting Medicaid ostensibly is to save the federal government money. How much does the federal government spend on Medicaid in Alaska?
$2.7 billion for healthcare services in Alaska last year. And Alaska paid just 24% of that number, about $634 million. So as former health commissioner Valerie Davidson pointed out, that's a really good deal for Alaska. Jared Kozin, president and CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association, said if Congress makes big cuts to Medicaid, the impact on people who use Medicaid in Alaska, as well as the hospitals and providers that serve them, would be enormous.
It would be catastrophic, not only for the healthcare system, for Alaskans across our entire state.
Almost every corner of the healthcare system in the state relies heavily on Medicaid. That includes hospitals, clinics and private practice offices, and the tribal healthcare system.
All right, so maybe one of the big questions about this, if Medicaid is cut, then what happens to beneficiaries in the state?
So it depends on how the cuts are rolled out, but the state could disenroll categories of people, leaving them without insurance, or the state could make up the funding difference, but that would be an enormous hit to the state budget when it's already strained. There isn't a simple way to cut the state Medicaid budget without increasing healthcare costs for the state down the line. One way to cut the funding that's been floated is that the expansion program could change from a 90% federal match to a 50% match, so it's the same as regular Medicaid. But Kosin said just that one cut would still cost the state millions.
So if the feds say, hey, we're going to roll this back and we're going to only cover half of Medicaid expansion, you cover the rest.
If that happens, Kosin says Alaska would have to come up with at least $330 million. The state could also shut down the expansion program completely, but Kosin said leaving more Alaskans uninsured would just cost more in the long term, and all Alaskans would feel the result of those uninsured residents. Wealthier Alaskans might still have a choice of care, but for the uninsured who can't afford to pay out of pocket, their only choice will be ER care, because ERs can't turn people away, and that's really expensive. Average emergency room bills run in the thousands of dollars compared to just hundreds of dollars for most urgent care or doctor's visits. And if people can't afford to pay ER bills, they just won't. And that will drive up the cost of healthcare for all Alaskans, even people with private insurance.
So along with what we're hearing might be cut, what else is there that could be facing the axe?
So the state could cut so-called optional Medicaid services, such as dental care, vision care, or in-home care, but also those wouldn't likely cut costs in the long run. Lawmakers have also talked about adding work requirements to Medicaid, which is just a default way to force some people out of the program. Or the government could cap Medicaid spending for each state. But again, rationing care likely would lead to more use of emergency services and drive up healthcare costs in Alaska.
It sounds like a lot of this is sort of to be determined, though, right? In terms of, like you said, how the cuts are rolled out. And I imagine at this point, we don't really know what's going to happen.
Yeah, we don't know exactly what's going to happen. But any major cuts we do know would seriously impact care and finances in Alaska.
All right. Well, we have a longer, more detailed version of this story at alaskapublic.org. That was Alaska Public Media's health reporter, Rachel Cassandra. Rachel, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Casey.
The National Weather Service announced late last month that it was suspending weather balloon observations in Kotzebue indefinitely and immediately. That leaves a huge data gap for a large area of the Arctic. But as KOTZ's Desiree Hagen reports, a California-based company announced a day later that it plans to partially fill that void.
Every day across the world, hundreds of weather balloons are released at the same time, twice a day, to gather weather and climate data. Here in Alaska, it's at 3 a.m. and 3 p.m. Versions of this practice have been used since the 1930s. That consistency is important.
This is very important data that goes into weather models and climate models, as well as every operational weather model in the world, not just the U.S., every single one.
University of Alaska Fairbanks climatologist Rick Toman previously worked for the Weather Service for more than 30 years. He says losing streams of high-detailed synchronized data from Kotzebue and other sites undermines everything from global climate change research to the snow forecast in Selawik on Tuesday. Toman says Kotzebue's weather station covered a massive area and also provided crucial redundancies for the closest stations in Nome and Utqiagvik. Now, if there's a failure in Nome...
So Nome goes out. Now we have nothing in the Bering Sea region. There's nothing on the Russian side for hundreds, thousand miles.
The National Weather Service did not respond to questions for this story, but said in its announcement that the suspension is due to lack of staffing. Alaska Public Media reports that at least 23 Weather Service employees across Alaska have been fired or resigned following a wave of government-wide layoffs the Trump administration ordered. The Associated Press reports that at least 20 states are suing multiple federal agencies over the administration's mass firing of federal employees. A day after the Weather Service announcement, a private company announced it will provide atmospheric data for the area that includes Kotzebue, free over the next 6 months. It's not a perfect replacement, but the company says it will help offset the lost data stream. John Dean is the CEO for the company Windborne Systems. It's based in Silicon Valley and specializes in using smart weather balloons and AI forecasting.
In some sense, the more remote that an area is, often the more valuable the data is because you have no other data nearby. And so for any given site to stop being able to launch balloons, this is one of the more unfortunate ones in terms of how it will impact U.S. weather forecasts.
The 28-year-old Dean, along with the company's other founders, previously worked for Elon Musk's SpaceX. Dean says he did not have prior knowledge about Kotzebue's balloon suspension.
Windborne's really happy to step up here and kind of fill this gap of data that's going to be created by not having enough resources to launch weather balloons.
Windborne's balloons will be launched from a site in Fairbanks that is set to open this month. Windborne's balloons fly for weeks at a time and rise and fall using vents and ballasts. The Weather Service's balloons burst after a few hours. Windborne's won't float near Kotzebue, but instead be pulled by prevailing winds toward the North Pole, which means more data per launch, but not equivalent data. Even though Windborne's data won't be localized to Kotzebue, it can provide a wider view of weather patterns. Toman says it's not a substitute for traditional weather balloons that provide more information in the lowest areas of the atmosphere, where all weather occurs.
As the balloon goes up, you're getting three different things: pressure, temperature, and humidity. And by tracking where it goes, then you can derive the winds. And you're getting that in very high detail. You're getting basically an observation more or less continuously.
Dean says he doesn't want to see traditional weather balloons go away, but he says his company's system is relatively inexpensive.
I like the model of public-private partnership quite a lot, where a private company does services on behalf of the government. And then through that process, you can have competition and you can have the lowest price.
Dean says Windborne's balloons can also lessen environmental impacts.
Every day, 200 traditional weather balloons are launched in the United States, and the vast majority of them are not recovered and they become environmental waste.
13 balloon launch sites remain in Alaska. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Ketchikan woman hopes to prove once and for all she has the biggest mouth in the world.
Because I'm used to, as a child, shoving large objects in my mouth for fun, because you got siblings, you know, and you tend to stick stuff in your mouth when you have siblings to show off.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University empowers students to make a positive difference in their communities through programs in education, business, outdoor studies, public health, and more. Scholarship and other financial aid opportunities are available. Learn more and apply now at alaskapacific.edu to automatically be considered for most scholarships. Advance your career and your community with APU today. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
The American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU of Alaska, is suing the State Department of Corrections for its alleged role in the 2023 death of Lewis Jordan Jr. Jordan was incarcerated at Goose Creek Correctional Complex outside of Wasilla, where he developed bacterial meningitis, which led to his coma and death. The ACLU is suing on behalf of Jordan's family. Megan Barker is communications director for the ACLU of Alaska. Barker says Jordan's health decline started with an ear infection and staff ignored his pleas for help.
And these were medical issues that could have been fixed with pretty easily identifiable solutions and treatments. And instead, they were ignored to the point that Mr. Jordan was found unconscious in his cell and taken to the hospital in a coma, where he then died.
Jordan remained in a coma for about a month before he was removed from life support. The Department of Corrections did not respond to a request for comment in time for this story, but the department's health director, Travis Welch, presented data on prison deaths to the State House State Affairs Committee on Monday. Welch said the incarcerated population in Alaska has especially complex health needs.
65% of those in our care and custody are living with a mental illness. Of that, 22% of our population is experiencing a severe and persistent mental illness, such as schizophrenia or other. 80% are living with a substance use disorder. People in our care and custody are twice as likely as the greater Alaskan population to have high blood pressure.
The Department of Corrections announced that another inmate, Reginald Eugene Childers, Jr., died in state custody last Monday. Childers was 42 and had been incarcerated for about 2 months. He was still awaiting trial. State troopers determined the death was a suicide and no foul play is suspected. For years, the Haynesboro School District has stayed afloat, even amid flatlined state education funding and soaring inflation. But not anymore. The district, like so many others in Alaska, is facing a budget shortfall this year. The situation has forced the district to ask the local government for a financial lifeline. The Alaska Desk's Avery Elfelt has more.
Sophia Armstrong is a first-grade teacher in Haynes. She says teaching is her calling. She's been doing it here for 14 years already, and plans to work in education the rest of her career. But years of poor retirement benefits and low pay are forcing her to rethink whether it's wise to do so in Haynes or anywhere else in Alaska.
I'm actually, you know, one of those people who's going, Alaska, get it together or I'm out of here. And it's sad because I really want to stay in Alaska. I love this town. I love this community. I love this school.
Local governments are legally allowed to fund school districts up to a maximum level. Historically, Haynes hasn't funded the district to that cap. But Roy Getchell, the superintendent, said during a February assembly meeting that he plans to ask the borough to fund the district to that amount for the first time in over a decade. Without the additional support, he said during the meeting, the district could run an $880,000 deficit next year.
We've been really conscientious working as a school district with the support of the board to not come running to you every time we have a need. But we are at the point where without support, things are going to start to change, and they'll start to change dramatically.
Getchell says the biggest impact so far is on staff and the students they serve. But funding from the state has made it impossible for the district to offer pay and benefits that would help retain current employees like Armstrong. The district saw nearly a third of its staff turnover in fiscal year 2025. And even more the year before. But that's not the only consequence. Insufficient state funding is also making it harder for Haynes to attract strong teaching applicants when jobs open up after teachers do resign or retire.
We've had many folks on the line who are ready to make the move, but when we offer a salary, it's no. They plug it into a cost of living calculator or they compare it to where they are, and it's not competitive anymore.
Getchell says the vast majority of applicants for open jobs are from overseas and would require visas. On the other hand, only a fraction have degrees from the state university system. He sees those applicants as the strongest because they are more likely to stick around. School districts across the state are reckoning with budget shortfalls driven by Alaska's failure to increase funding in step with inflation. A report published last week by the Institute of Social and Economic Research underscores the problem. Researchers concluded that state spending is 15% below the national average, even after adjusting for higher relative costs, a major problem for hiring. There's some momentum in the state legislature to address the situation, says Nils Andreasen, the executive director of Alaska Municipal League.
I think there's general consensus to see some increase. What the dollar amount is, that's really the debate.
That could happen by way of an education bill lawmakers unveiled early this month that would increase per student funding by $1,000, but doesn't include further increases or inflation proofing. Absent intervention, Andreasen says, funding shortfalls will continue to drive a sprawling set of issues in school districts, ranging from program cuts and larger class sizes to school closures. Districts in Anchorage and Kodiak, for instance, are already set to close at least one school later this year. In Southeast, similar moves are under consideration in Ketchikan and Sitka. Haynes hasn't been hit as hard as other parts of the state, but that's starting to shift, and the number one symptom is a teacher shortage. For Armstrong, the situation is becoming less and less sustainable as she takes on more responsibility each year with fewer resources.
I shouldn't be really poor when I have a college degree and I work really hard and I have now 20 years experience. Like, I should be able to afford eggs.
Absent change, she says, the situation will mean fewer highly qualified teachers and less support in classrooms that need both. In Haynes, I'm Avery Elfelt.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, keeping schools and students connected across the state with a resilient and redundant network.
details at gci.com/education. Did you know 100 years ago, the chances of a baby dying in Alaska before their first birthday was almost 10%? Because of advances in public health like sanitation, access to clean water, vaccines for children, and access to healthcare in rural communities, the chances of dying are now less than 1%. To learn more about what the Alaska Department of Health is doing to improve Alaskans' health for the next 100 years, visit health.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
A 4-year-old dog in the Iditarod Trail sled dog race collapsed and died Friday afternoon, according to race officials. It's the first dog death of the 2025 race. In a statement, race officials said the dog named Ventana was on rookie musher Daniel Klein's team. Ventana collapsed outside of the Galena checkpoint about a third of the way into the race. According to the statement, attempts to revive Ventana were not successful. Iditarod officials said a necropsy found Ventana was pregnant, and more testing will be done to determine her cause of death. Klein then dropped out of the race in line with the competition's rules. And Iditarod leaders are racing up the frozen Yukon River on their way to Caltag, nearly 3/4 of the way into the competition. Jesse Holmes is in the lead, chased by Paige Drobny and Matt Hall. Those teams, and those of most mushers, are comprised of sled dogs bred for these long-distance competition. And then there's Justin Olness. The Alaska Desk's Shelby Herbert brings us the story of Olness's underdog team, comprised mostly of shelter adoptees.
11 dogs on rookie Justin Olness's team of 15 came from Fairbanks's animal shelter or from other rescue organizations throughout Alaska. And that includes his lead dog, a 3-year-old female named Fly.
She's truly an extraordinary dog. And it's just cool that she also happens to have been a puppy that we adopted from the shelter, along with her brother Tippett, who's also a very good dog. But sorry, Tippett, I just have to say Fly is something else. She is a very good, headstrong, strong leader. I don't think she's reached her full potential, and that makes me really excited.
Olness and his wife Kaylin operate Rerun Kennel just outside Fairbanks, and their mission is to promote dog mushing while providing homes for rescue dogs in need. He says racing with rescues can be kind of a gamble.
When you go to the shelter and you see a dog that may have potential to want to run distance or race, you're looking at its conformation, its attitude, its build. Beyond that, you may not know much, so you're only going to find out by adopting that dog and giving it a go.
While sure, there are some risks, or just genetic and behavioral question marks, Olness says there's also big benefits to having a more eclectic kennel.
You get a little bit more variety in your kennel, so you're not pigeonholed by whatever line you're breeding. And that variety means that you have dogs that are capable and adept at different things, and you can kind of mix and match as you need.
He says there have been a lot of racing success stories among the dogs he and his wife rescue, but even the ones who don't make the cut get important jobs.
It hasn't panned out all the time. In that case, we might find something else for that dog. Some of those dogs that we have just run shorter distances, or we use them to socialize with dogs that we foster.
When Olness arrived at the Galena checkpoint on Friday, he said he and his dogs experienced plenty of twists and turns on the first 400 miles of trail, including a sandstorm. But they're in good spirits.
As many folks talk about the Iditarod Trail as being an emotional roller coaster, that's definitely been the case so far. But overall, it's been a great experience. It's amazing country, and I'm very happy to be out here.
Olness's team isn't leading the pack this year, but his main goal is to finish in Nome with all dogs healthy and happy. Secondary to that, he just wants to showcase all the talent and potential that was previously hidden away in Alaska's shelters. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Shelby Herbert.
And a quick race update. A total of 6 mushers have scratched from the Iditarod for a variety of reasons, leaving 27 teams still in the race. Well, for most people, being told you have a big mouth, those are fighting words. But for one Alaskan, it could mean a world record. A Ketchikan woman recently went for a Guinness World Record for largest female mouth gape. KRBD's Jack Darrell saw her record-shattering jaw in person and has more.
Come on, baby. 6.69, 6.8, no, 7.37.
Marie Pearl Zelmer Robinson has her eyes on the record for the largest female mouth gape in the world. She's getting her shockingly wide open mouth measured by a pair of steel calipers at a dentist's office in Ketchikan. her husband is recording. Robinson can easily fit a 12-ounce aluminum can between her teeth, no problem. She says she's been aware of her remarkable jaw since she was a kid.
Because I'm used to, as a child, shoving large objects in my mouth for funds, because you got siblings, you know, and you tend to stick stuff in your mouth when you have siblings to show off.
Robinson is in it for a Guinness World Record.
Every time I see somebody do something amazing, I'm like, well, I can't do that. But this one was one that I could do, and I surprised myself even.
A little over a decade ago, nearly 2,000 Ketchikan residents broke the world record for largest rain boot race. Like, everyone wore rain boots and raced across the Third Avenue bypass. But not long after, they were dethroned by an athletic club in Ireland. Robinson says she couldn't get off work to join the race, but it inspired her. A Connecticut woman named Samantha Ramsdell currently holds the record for largest female mouth gape. She also holds the record for world's widest mouth. She's popular on social media for pushing Pringles cans and wine bottles past her shockingly widespread, almost frog-like lips.
And it was very obvious that she could win a record with that mouth. But they had not only done width, but they had done height as well.
Robinson says when she saw the actual height of Ramsdell's open mouth, she thought, I can do better than that. So she submitted an application to Guinness, and they accepted it. Then she had to prove it. And Robinson says Guinness World Records verification process is pretty strict. She says she first went for the record over a year ago, but didn't get the witness statements and the filming quite to Guinness's exacting standards. So she tried again 6 months later, but then she realized her gaping mouth had grown by a couple millimeters.
So that helped me practice so that, you know, I could get my head in the right position, because when you're measuring something that large, you got to put your head back. Otherwise, the measurement device is starting to hit your chest.
So she started practicing, yawning as wide as she could. While she was driving around for work, she and her husband co-founded a local delivery service.
And I'm certain people drove past me wondering, you know, why is that person's mouth super wide open?
Robinson says she doesn't think her skill necessarily runs in the family.
I'm pretty sure what happened is my jaw is just positioned in such a way that it's just slightly further back. Like, I can feel my jaw in my ear canal, which most people apparently don't.
Ramsdell's reigning record is about 6.5 centimeters. Robinson's open jaw clocked in at over 7.5 centimeters, which is about 3 inches vertically from her bottom to top teeth. That might not sound like much, but grab a tape measure, check for yourself. It is. Now that Robinson submitted her measurements to Guinness for review, it's a waiting game.
Are you going to have a party to celebrate the publishing?
Well, as a extreme introvert with social anxiety disorder, probably not. Yeah. But I will post it and let everybody know, and probably send flowers to my dentist.
Robinson hopes to see herself flexing her wide open mouth in the world record book by next year, if not sooner. In Ketchikan, I'm Jack Darrell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Rachel Cassandra and Ava White in Anchorage, Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue, Avery Elfelt in Haines, Shelby Herbert in Fairbanks, and Jack Darrell in Ketchikan. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer tonight is Tobin Shelby. Annie Fight produced tonight's show, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 47 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com. The Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, located in downtown Fairbanks with 400 guest rooms and 1,700 square feet of meeting space. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.
You were so blind. Savoir faire. No one in the whole universe will ever compare. is so cold. Singing while we watch them fall. Show you your
sunshine on the horizon, over two young lovers while it's going down. Somewhere the same sun rising on another two lovers as the world goes around. Same scene played over and over, same sweet passion, same warm blood. Softly speaking the universal language, so many lovers, one love. Struggle about a righteous way. Can't see the forest for all the frustrations. So many lying, so many dying, but only one passion, same red blood. Universal language goes unspoken. Too much hatred, too much hatred now, but only one love. On the horizon, over two young lovers, while it's going down.